This is Fresh Air. Sleater-Kinney is one of the most widely praised rock bands of the last 20 years. The band formed in the mid-90s in Olympia, Washington, and went on to record 7 albums. The group split up in 2006, but have reunited to release a new album called No Cities to Love. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it's a strong comeback.
Hey, darling, you're not home. This is your phone, though, right?
Thing that comes from fame is mediocrity, sings Corin Tucker on that song, Hey Darling. That assertion is debatable. I can think of quite a few other things that can come from fame. But Sleater-Kinney doesn't have to worry about mediocrity. Famous within a nexus of cult stardom and critical acclaim, the band has come roaring back with a confident urgency that is exhilarating to hear. That's Price Tag, a song whose lyric is about people working low-paying jobs in our dodgy economy. The words tell the details. Corin Tucker's voice communicates the frustration and pain. Tucker has always been an extraordinary vocalist. She has a huge voice that cuts across the guitars and drums like a scraper chipping away ice on a car's windshield. Words frequently disappear when they emerge from Tucker's throat. It helps to hunt down lyrics if you want to know what a song is about, although most of the time, the song is really about the sound of Corin Tucker's voice, whatever bold or agonized or joyous sound it's making. Together do we break the rules, goes the chorus of that song, Surface Envy. The second line makes a crucial shift, changing break to make the rules. Powered by Brownstein's guitar and Weiss's drumming, Sleater-Kinney forms a three-person collective that makes its own rules about how a song is constructed, how much of a structure it needs to work as rock and roll, and how little it takes to explode that structure. On their best songs, and there are quite a few here, Sleater-Kinney music consists of irreducible chunks of melody, riffs, and noise. Few bands reform with their power as intact as Sleater-Kinney have. Fewer still brag about their power and make the claim something more than a brag.
Okay.
In the years since Sleater-Kinney disbanded in 2006, its members have done other projects. Brownstein co-created the TV comedy Portlandia with Fred Armisen. Weiss was the drummer in, among others, the band Wild Flag. And there's been a good group called the Corin Tucker Band. But with an album like No Cities to Love, it seems as though there's no work these women do that is more important, more enjoyable, and more challenging than the music they create as Sleater-Kinney. I'm really looking forward to seeing them when they start their tour.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed the new album from Sleater-Kinney, No Cities to Love. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
In eastern Peru, wildcat gold miners are seeking their fortune in the headwaters of the Amazon. But in the process, they're polluting the river with mercury. A new research paper from scientists at Duke University finds toxic residue from the mines hundreds of miles downstream. NPR's global health correspondent Jason Bobian reports.
Over the last decade, thousands of people have moved to a remote part of the Amazon jungle in eastern Peru. They're hoping to strike it rich, or at least find work from the gold mining boom. Unfortunately, the process of extracting tiny specks of gold from the riverbed of the Madre de Dios River involves mercury, and it's poisoning the waterway. Researchers say mercury is showing up downstream at levels that pose a significant public health threat.
Bill Pan, I'm assistant professor in the Global Health Institute at Duke, and I've been working in Peru for about 10 years.
Pan started out looking at environmental issues related to the recently completed interoceanic highway that links Brazil to the Pacific Ocean. And while doing that, he noticed that wildcat miners were having a huge impact on the region. In addition to infusing cash into this remote part of the jungle, they were cutting down trees and tearing up the riverbanks. Many of the miners operate on floating makeshift barges in the river. Pan says the barges are about the size of two compact cars strapped together.
You get these little tiny boats where there are two Hondas hooked together with this enormous tube that someone will dive down into the bottom of the river with a scuba suit or some kind of connected to some tube so they can breathe underwater. And they're just on the bottom of the river sucking up the dirt.
The miners then use mercury to extract the flecks of gold from the sludge. The mercury binds to the gold and the rest of the sediment is dumped overboard. Some of the mercury, however, clings to the slurry and ends up in the river. The team from Duke found dangerously high mercury levels, not just near the mining operations, but far downstream.
There's definitely strong correlations between where the mining is occurring and where people are at risk for mercury toxicity. And that risk actually stays elevated, you know, for hundreds of miles.
This current report just looks at the levels of mercury in fish and river sediment. An earlier study in 2013 from the Carnegie Institute looked at the impact on people. It found mercury levels far above what the World Health Organization views as acceptable. Mercury exposure can lead to neurological damage, and it's particularly dangerous for pregnant women and young children. Hyeleen Shi Kim, who worked on the Duke study, says it's clear that mercury levels in fish and people have been going up as mining has expanded.
There's been an increase certainly in the last 10 years, and the increase tracks, it's like almost one-to-one with the global price of gold. And with that increase in the price of gold, there's been an increase in mining in this area.
The government of Peru has attempted to crack down on illegal miners operating on the Madre de Dios River. The Peruvian Navy has even blown up some of the barges. But with gold prices remaining well above $1,000 an ounce, laborers are flocking to the boats, where they can earn far more than in most other jobs in the area. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
Last night, about further improving the U.S. economy, he nodded to the role the Internet plays in economic development.
I intend to protect a free and open Internet, extend its reach to every classroom and every community, and help folks build the fastest networks.
Those seem like goals everyone can support, but there's deep disagreement over how to achieve them. And those few words hint at looming clashes between the White House and the big phone and cable companies. Here's NPR's Joel Rose.
President Obama has picked a couple of fights with the powerful telecom industry lately. Last week, he traveled to Iowa to show his support for municipal broadband.
Hello, Cedar Falls!
20 years ago, Cedar Falls, Iowa, decided to build its own high-speed internet network, which is now among the fastest in the country. There are towns that would like to do the same because their other broadband options are too slow or too expensive or simply don't exist. But some cities find themselves blocked by state laws.
In too many places across America, some big companies are doing everything they can to keep out competitors. Today, in 19 states, we've got laws on the books that stamp out competition.
The president is urging the Federal Communications Commission to preempt state laws that restrict municipal broadband, but not everyone thinks the commission has the legal authority to do that.
That's a complete legal fantasy.
Baron Soka is president of Tech Freedom, a market-oriented think tank in Washington. He says President Obama's speech in Iowa was a missed opportunity to encourage more private investment in broadband networks.
And instead, not only did he call for government-run broadband as the first answer, he called for the FCC to do something that is unconstitutional, that is going to lose in court.
The president's supporters and at least one federal judge would dispute that. What the FCC can or cannot do is a hot topic these days. The fight over municipal broadband is just the beginning. The main event is the battle over open internet rules. The president is urging the commission to protect the principle of net neutrality, the idea that internet service providers should treat all of the traffic on their pipes equally. He's asking the FCC to do it in the strongest possible way.
The commission is preparing to invoke net neutrality's nuclear option.
Congressman Greg Walden is a Republican from Oregon. He's also the chair of the House Subcommittee on Communications and Technology, which held a hearing today on its own plan to protect the open internet. Walden and others think it would be a mistake for the FCC to reclassify broadband as a communication service, like the federally regulated telephone companies. Michael Powell is a lobbyist for the cable TV industry. He says that kind of heavy-handed approach could lead to less investment.
We want every American to have access to the internet, and we're impatient about that. It's simply common sense to understand increasing regulatory cost, increasing uncertainty, certainly will slow the magnitude or the pace.
Powell says it's Congress, not the FCC, that should write new rules of the road for the internet. Republicans on the subcommittee offered some. They say their proposal would, among other things, prevent broadband providers from charging internet companies more for special fast lanes. But Chad Dickerson, the CEO of the online marketplace Etsy, testified that the proposal is full of loopholes.
Etsy is a low-margin business. We couldn't afford to pay for priority access to consumers. Yet we know that delays of even milliseconds have a direct and long-term impact on revenue.
Critics of the draft rules think their real intent is to strip the FCC of its power to regulate broadband providers. Democrat Ann Eshoo of California is the subcommittee's ranking member.
What is abundantly clear in the majority's proposal is to purposely tie the hands of the FCC by prohibiting them from reclassifying broadband.
Reclassification is what the president wants, and it's what the FCC is expected to vote on next month. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
Yeah. Last night, President Obama was crowing about the economy.
We've seen the fastest economic growth in over a decade, our deficits cut by two-thirds, a stock market that has doubled, and healthcare inflation at its lowest rate in 50 years.
But wait, just the other day, Senate Majority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell suggested that growth didn't come from the Democrats. Here's what he said on the Senate floor.
The uptick appears to coincide with the biggest political change of the Obama administration's long tenure in Washington. The expectation of a new Republican Congress.
So who should get credit for a possible economic recovery? We're going to ask Kenneth Rogoff. He's professor of economics at Harvard University and former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So you just heard those two quotes. Do you hear two parties claiming real credit, or is there some hedging in those boasts?
Well, they were both there when it happened. I mean, I think there's just no debating that this recovery, given the depth of the financial crisis, has really been very solid. Both parties are trying to claim credit for it, but it's certainly true for a long time the Republicans were criticizing President Obama and saying it's not good enough. But if you look at other countries, it really could have been a lot worse.
At this point, what is the consensus among economists about what actually did help the economy recover?
Consensus among economists. You're asking a tall order. I think there's no doubt that the Federal Reserve did a lot of heavy lifting, although it had to do a lot of experimentation along the way to see what worked. I think that the so-called bank stress tests, where back in May 2009, they tried to figure out just how bad things were. That also was something that helped tremendously. It sort of put a floor under how bad the panic was. And then the fiscal stimulus started under George Bush. President Obama essentially doubled it when he came in. And I think all of these things contributed. People don't know. There's a lot of debate. Certainly what the Federal Reserve did, everybody agrees, was great.
Talk a little bit more about the Federal Reserve. I mean, do they essentially deserve most of the credit? And they're not exactly controlled by the president, right, by the executive office.
So what the Federal Reserve did the most was take out the panic. It did things like simply put money into the system so that people knew they'd be able to get their money out. It did things that were just incredibly out of the box. But so too did the government. And the truth of the matter is, when you face a crisis like this, you throw the kitchen sink at it. You're never quite sure what worked. But thankfully, we didn't have another Great Depression.
You're at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, talking to economists from around the world. What are they saying? I mean, especially economists, say, from Europe, which isn't recovering in the same way.
I think actually everyone everywhere in the world is looking at the United States and wondering how it's managed to do so well, wondering how they could do things better. And that may seem very strange, being in the United States, where we wish it was a lot better. But Europe is in much worse shape, in large part because they don't really have a central government over the Eurozone. Imagine if Texas and Massachusetts had to agree on every policy the way, say, Germany and France do. And even the European Central Bank, that's the equivalent of Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve, they don't really have the same remit that the Federal Reserve does. And so they've been trying to struggle with that. But even you can go to Asia, other places, and everyone admires how the U.S. economy has managed to take this huge punch and managed to come back, and now is really something of the envy of the world.
That's Kenneth Rogoff, professor of economics at Harvard University and former chief economist of the IMF. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.